Okay, I think we left off with discussing why they have periorbital puffiness, why they have kind of hoarse throats, kind of very, very hoarse throats, why they get pretibial myxedema. What do all of those things have in common? An increase in glycosaminoglycan deposition. Okay, and so there's an increase in glycosaminoglycan deposition in the vocal cords, and they get hoarse throats, in the periorbital tissue of the eye, and so they get that periorbital puffiness. And they can even get it in the tibial area, a non-pitting type of edema related to an increase in glycosaminoglycan. So this is the second thing that we've seen, something related to an increase in glycosaminoglycans. What's the first thing? It's called mitral valve prolapse, guys. I told you there was an increase in dermatan sulfate that was responsible for causing an excess and redundancy of the valve. So here's another pathologic example of an increase in glycosaminoglycans, and that is in Graves' disease and Hashimoto's disease. Actually, they're at the opposite ends of the spectrum, really. Graves' disease, for example, is due to, and I should have said this actually, it's due to an IgG antibody against the receptor, the TSH receptor. It's an IgG antibody against the TSH receptor, Graves' disease. And when it hooks into it, it just causes the gland to continue to synthesize. What type of hypersensitivity reaction is that? Antibody against the receptor. Two, another example is myasthenia gravis. Okay, they have an antibody against the receptor, which is destroying the receptor. That's type 2 also, so that fits under that purview. And interesting, Hashimoto's thyroiditis, they have an IgG antibody against the TSH receptor too, except instead of activating the gland, it inhibits it. So basically, Hashimoto's and Graves' disease are both autoimmune diseases, but they're at opposite ends of the spectrum. One has a stimulatory IgG antibody, the other one has an inhibitory one. And so don't be surprised that they have maybe some overlapping signs and symptoms, and one of them is pretibial myxedema and glycosaminoglycan deposition. They both can have that. Both can have that particular abnormality, and that's glycosaminoglycans. How about a decrease in glycosaminoglycans? What diseases would that be? Let's say a problem with the metabolism of glycosaminoglycans. Lysosomal storage diseases, okay? Hurler's disease, Hunter's disease. You lack a lysosomal enzyme for breaking down dermatan sulfate and those kinds of things. Okay, that's going to be biochemistry. The fact that you didn't know that means you're going to be here next week, right, listening, Dr. Hansen. Well, some of you did. You're just not saying anything because you're so humble, unlike myself. Okay. Now, you know the signs and symptoms of hypothyroidism. Actually, the most common is weakness, muscle weakness. And the reason for that is that all patients with hypothyroidism have proximal muscle myopathy. And they can't really get up out of chairs too easily. The serum CKs are elevated. Okay, that's actually the most common symptom. But other ones include brittle hair, kind of coarse skin, a little slow in mentation, okay? And then this periorbital puffiness, delayed Achilles reflex, constipation, diastolic hypertension, not systolic hypertension. You know these different things. Now, this is a biopsy of a thyroid gland. This was on a boards once. And someone with Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and I defy you to tell me that that looks like normal thyroid gland. Where's the follicles? I don't see a single one, but I do see a germinal follicle. And the reason why you see this is because it's an autoimmune destruction of the gland. Okay, there's going to be cytotoxic T cells in here, and they're destroying this thing. And also you're going to be can be synthesizing some antibody, some IgG antibody in there. So there's your germinal follicle. So it kind of looks like a lymph node, the thyroid gland in Hashimoto's thyroiditis. So what are we going to see? We can see a what T4? Low. What's a TSH? High. They don't usually do I-131 uptakes, but if they did, what would it be? Low. Very good. That's the end of the discussion on that. We already did this. But let's do it again. All right, estrogen. Someone's on estrogen. What would that do to the T4? Increase it. TSH? Normal. Of course, you're not going to do an I-131. I'm going to do an I-131 on a pregnant woman. Oh, that wouldn't be a good idea. Because who else's fibroid's going to take it up? The little dude. Okay, and what's going to end it up is that actually is a whopping dose. That actually would produce hypothyroidism in a little dude, and you'd end up with a little child with cretinism. That's right. Do you know that's response? Did you know that the brain isn't fully developed when a baby is born? Did you know that? That it takes about another year to a year and a half for it to be fully developed. And guess what hormone is totally responsible for that? Thyroid hormone. See, that's why it's so important to do newborn screens. You know, using, I don't know whether they use TSH or whether they use T4, I'm not exactly sure on that, to rule out cretinism or hypothyroidism in a newborn, because they're guaranteed being severely mentally retarded if you don't pick it up. Because the brain depends on thyroid hormone for its proper development after birth for the next year, year and a half. Very important that you pick it up. Otherwise, that poor little kid's doomed. Okay. Graves' disease, T4, please. High. TSH, low. I-131, high. Arnold Schwarzenegger. Okay, here he is on his anabolic. What's his T4? Low. His TSH, normal. We ought to give him I-131. Maybe it'll stimulate him a little bit. Okay, how about Hashimoto's thyroiditis? T4, low. TSH, high. I-131 would be low. Factitious, what does that mean? You're taking too much thyroid hormone. And you have signs of hyperthyroidism. Okay, what would the T4 be? High. TSH, low. So everything looks the same as Graves, but what would the I-131 be? Low. Very good. You guys should really be proud of yourselves. You're doing really good, actually. And I mean that. You are. That's excellent. What's this patient have by definition? A goiter. Anytime the thyroid's big. So actually, in Graves' disease, they have diffuse enlargement of the gland. That's a goiter. It fits it. This patient has a goiter. This is what the glands oftentimes look like with goiters. They got lots of cysts and stuff like in them. In fact, this one had a hemorrhage in it. The most common cause of a goiter is iodine deficiency. That's the most common. Not some kind of enzyme defect in the synthesis. That's more common, like say, in kids that may have hypothyroidism, some genetic thing where they're missing an enzyme or something like that. But most often it's due to low iodide levels. And so in a sense, they have either hypothyroidism or borderline hypothyroidism. Okay? And so their glands are sometimes are getting revved up because, you know, if your T4 starts going down and TSH is going to start increasing, it's beating on the gland, make more. And then it makes the T4 goes up and then TSH goes down. Boo. Okay, then it goes, you know, it's just a seesaw type of thing. You know, TSH is stimulating it, then it's not, and stimulating it, then it's not. The gland gets bigger over a period of time and produces a goiter. So that's why the treatment of choice for this is thyroxine. You give them the appropriate dose of thyroxine and doesn't have to do that anymore, then the gland actually starts coming back down to a normal size. And oftentimes that's all you need. But sometimes they'll have a nodule that you feel and say, you know, Doc, this thing, this bump in my neck over here just came up yesterday. Okay, and you feel it and all that stuff. Okay, that's this. What happens is some of the nodules that develop in the thyroid gland in these goiters get hemorrhage. And so that sudden increase is due to hemorrhage within a cyst in that goiter. Very common. And so, you know, you know that you can diagnose this easily with a fine needle aspiration. You stick your needle into that, blood would come out, send it to a cytologist, and they say benign cells in there, so you know you're dealing with that. And so what they would usually do off the bat first, give them thyroid hormone, and a lot of times these things will go away or things will start getting smaller. And that's it. That's goiter. So most cases are due to decreased iodide levels. You see, in this country, we iodinize salt. And so we don't see a whole lot of goiters in this country. Now, there's certain areas of our country here in the United States where people are not taking iodized things and you see goiters. The Great Lakes area around Chicago is a very iodine-poor area. And a lot of, in the olden days, you know, there was a lot of goiter in that area. Britain. In Great Britain, I don't think they iodinize their salt. I'm not exactly sure on that, but I remember reading that someplace. And they brought up the fact that when they get Graves' disease in Britain, It's not due to an increase in T4, it's mainly an increase in T3. They get a T3 toxicosis, and it's said in the books that I read that the reason why it's more likely a T3 toxicosis is that they're iodine deficient and don't have enough iodide to make T4. And so they basically make T3 and have their Graves' disease. Now, I don't know whether that's still true, but I remember reading it in an internal medicine book. I did write a book on most commons in medicine, so I'd read a lot of different things. And I remember them saying that about in Britain, Great Britain, there's a higher incidence of T3 toxicosis than in our country here, and that's because of iodine deficiency. Maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. I don't know. Oh, by the way, I was told that basketball player is not from Croatia, but from Romania, the one I was thinking about. I always get told, no, that's not my country. It's this country. It's always dangerous when you're in a UN meeting here. Always dangerous. It's always more interesting, though. Very interesting. Okay, the cold nodule. Now, a lot of you think that means you feel the neck and it's cold. Okay, and you can't get your finger up there. Like, you know, you put your tongue on a flagpole and winter, I can't get it off. And a lot of you think, hot nodule. Hot nodule. No. It's talking about whether that nodule is taking up I-131 or not. Okay, well, this obviously didn't. Because when they gave I-131, the normal gland that was making hormone took it up, but that nodule didn't. So it's a little area of lucency. So that's called a cold nodule. Now, just for fun, if it was a hot nodule, what would you have seen? There'd be a black dot right there, right in the location, and there would be none of this other stuff. Why is that? Because if that nodule is autonomously making thyroid hormone, what's TSH? Decreased. And if TSH is decreased, then wouldn't that suppress the normal portion of the thyroid gland? And so it would undergo atrophy, would not take it up. So this dude would be totally black. There'd be just a black dot there and he would see nothing else. See, that's the concept of negative feedback, guys, and you really got to get used to that. That's what's tested on endocrinology. You know these little negative feedback things. That's a good example of one right there. What's the chance that a cold nodule is malignant in a woman? About 15-20%. Most of cold nodules in a woman, an older woman, or an adult woman, let's just say that, are benign. In fact, most of them are cysts. A small percentage are what they call follicular adenomas, which are benign, and then about 15-20% are actually cancer. Not true for a man. Any cold nodule in a man is cancer until proven otherwise. Any cold nodule in a child is cancer until proven otherwise. Any person, male, female, kid, Martian, who head and neck area exposed to radiation, cold nodule, cancer. Papillary carcinoma of the thyroid. So any exposure in the head and neck area, cold nodule, cancer. So those are your statistics. And by the way, the cold nodule in the adult, female, New England Journal of Medicine, article on the solitary cold nodule of the thyroid gland. That's the information I just gave you. So let's talk about papillary and the different cancers. Now, you could look at this, and there's no way in God's green earth that you can tell me that's malignant. That could be a follicular adenoma, something benign, or it could be cancer, or it could be a multinodular goiter. You have no idea until you biopsy it. Of course, a fine needle aspiration would be able to do that. Do you think it would show up as a hot nodule or a cold nodule? This was papillary cancer. A cold nodule. So it would be one of those examples of a cold nodule in this case. And it turned out to be papillary cancer. Papillary means papillary, guys. It means it's got little papillary things like a fern. And what are these little bluish things that you see scattered throughout there? Seminoma bodies. Have you seen this picture before with the lymph node with the cancer in it? Yeah, I showed it as an example of metastasis in a carcinoma about 458 slides ago. Of course, I'm making up the number, but I'm trying to give some kind of idea. So what do papillary carcinomas, where would they metastasize? Cervical lymph nodes right next to it. And they commonly do. They have a very good prognosis, papillary cancer. So the most common one, They're the only one that actually is associated with the radiation exposure. And don't worry, you don't need to know about orphan antinuclei and nuclear cleaves. That's for pathology residents first year. You're not going to see crap like that on this exam. That is too specific. They're not interested in you being a pathologist. They want to know if you know something about papillary cancer, not its histology. This is follicular cancer. This is the second most common type, and this is the one that doesn't know it's a carcinoma, and it invades vessels. In fact, when they do surgery on known follicular cancers, they most of the time do not do node picking, looking in the cervical things, because they don't go to lymph nodes. They basically go hematogenous, which means they go to lungs and bone most frequently. Okay, then medullary carcinoma of the thyroid. Some cases are sporadic. Some cases have an autosomal dominant relationship. So what do you think the relationship is there? What syndromes? The men syndromes, and that's multiple endocrine neoplasia. That doesn't mean that men get the syndrome. This is men's syndrome, multiple endocrine neoplasia. 1, 2A, 2B. It's men 2B. Isn't that cute? They want to make it men 1, men 2, men 3. Terrible. Wrote in all kinds of letters and notes, no, keep men 2B. It means something to me. Get the rhyme on that? Very good. Okay. You can memorize as well as I can those different men's. You know, the men 1 is the pituitary tumor, is the parathyroid adenoma, the pancreatic tumor, usually Zollinger Ellison peptic ulcer. Then men 2A, what? Medullary carcinoma, pituitary pheochromocytoma. Men 2B, medullary carcinoma, pheochromocytoma, mucosal neuromas. Great memory abilities, right? Big deal. Have I seen this? Big time, I have. I've seen men's syndrome. Anybody happen to know what the name of that little thing that you can screen family members with to see if they have the potential for developing medullary carcinomas? RET. The RET proto-oncogene is associated with the men's syndrome. It's a proto-oncogene that codes for receptors, and it's very unique to the men's syndromes. RET proto-oncogene. This is a medullary carcinoma. You see this pink staining crap? Let's say we stained it with Congo red, then we polarize it. We got a little apple green birefringence. What does that mean this stuff is? Amyloid. And what did it come from? The tumor marker, which is calcitonin. Very good. Very good. That's the screening test of choice, actually, for medullary carcinoma. How would I ask it? I'd say, which cancer in the body, where would the cancer be located in the body where the tumor marker is converted into amyloid? It should be thyroid, medullary carcinoma of the thyroid. It's a bad cancer. It's not a good cancer. Papillary is the best. Follicular, the next best. Medullary is not so good. Here we go again with our counting. So everyone's going to have a lot of fun with this. I want to go through this calcium thing with you for two reasons. One is to understand how a person can have tetany and a normal total calcium. Okay, that's one reason. Okay, now watch this. This is a normal, you have all of these things in your notes, these little diagrams, just like you did for the T4. This is a normal situation. Calcium is bound and free. And of course, it's the free ionized calcium that is metabolically active. Everyone knows that. That's true of any hormone. The part that's bound is totally metabolically inactive. The part that's free is metabolically active. So who would this calcium be interacting with? Parathormone. If it was low, the free T4 level, parathormone high. If it was high, low. Okay. Low PTH. Okay, so this is all schematic here, guys. Notice that roughly, not exactly, one-third of the binding sites in albumin are occupied by calcium. Okay, so in other words, there's a pretty big, about roughly 40% of the total T4 is the calcium bound to albumin. Okay, and then I'm showing another thing that is bound. So that would be like phosphates and sulfates that would be floating around, just a little bit more. And then the remainder, usually roughly about 47% or so, is ionized calcium. This is the dude that is metabolically active. Okay, so the total calcium here would be 4 plus 5 plus 5 is 10. But the ionized calcium is 5. We're saying that's normal. You understand? What do you think the most common overall cause of hypocalcemia is? Hypoalbuminemia. If you have a low albumin level, then you're obviously going to have a decreased level because there's less albumin, then you're going to have less of the albumin that normally would have bound calcium. That's the absolute most common cause of hypocalcemia is a low albumin level. So before you start doing all kinds of different things looking for hypoparathyroidism, check the albumin level out first. If the albumin level is low, then that's the reason why the calcium level is low, because that's not affecting the free hormone level, it's just the albumin's decreased. It's kind of similar to thyroid-binding globulin being decreased, and what did it do to the total T4? Oh, it decreased it, but did it do anything to the free hormone level? No. Same thing here. Okay, it's not affecting this at all. I think that's what my next thing is that no. Okay. I'm going to show what happens when you have alkalosis. Now, this is all biochemistry. You ready? It doesn't matter whether it's respiratory or metabolic. Usually a little bit more common respiratory. Do you have a lot of hydrogen ions around in an alkalotic state? Yes or no? No, you don't. You don't. It's decreased. Remember, metabolic, respiratory alkalosis, what's the pH? What's the number? It's increased, but what's the hydrogen ion concentration? Decreased. Okay, now let me ask you a question. What are the acidic amino acids? Glutamate, aspartate, okay. Why are they acidic? Because they have COOH groups, as opposed to basic amino acids, they have more NH groups, okay? I'm going to ask you a question then. Albumin, the reason why it's such a great binder of calcium is it has the most negative charges of any protein in the body. That's because it has the most acidic amino acids in it. So I'm going to ask you, if you have an alkalotic state with less hydrogen ions, then those COOH groups become COO minus groups. Is that correct? Because if you have less hydrogen ions, then instead of having COOH there, it's COO minus. Agreed? So it has even more of a negative charge in an alkalotic state, which means it can bind more calcium. So where does it get it from? It kind of looking around and says, hey, I got more negative charges. Ooh, there's some free one down there. There's a whole pile of ionized calcium and sticks it on itself. Okay? Well, we haven't altered the total, have we? We just took it from Peter. We robbed Peter to pay Paul. In other words, we just took it down here and just put it up here. That hasn't affected the total, but it sure has decreased the ionized calcium level. So you're going to have fattening. But this is what I'm showing here. This is a normal. 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 5 of those. You have alkalosis. Okay? Now it's not 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 5 and 6. And it got 2 from here. Okay, so they moved up there. The total's still 1, 2. Total's still 6. 7 plus 3 is 10. Total's the same, but what's the ionized calcium level now? 3. You're going to get tetany. Well, that's not what they were interested in, really. They wanted to know the mechanism of tetany. There it is. You did have neurophys, didn't you? And I'm no expert on this threshold because it smacks of math to me. Okay? Remember you have a threshold for the action potential before the nerve or the muscle, you know, gets stimulated, right? And then you have a resting membrane potential. Is that correct? Well, what a decrease in ionized calcium level does is it lowers the threshold for activating the nerve or the muscle. So I'm showing... here's minus 60, that's the normal threshold, and above it, then you excite the muscle or the nerve in it, and you get an action potential. I'm showing that this here has been lowered down to here. So in other words, you're partially depolarized whenever you have a low ionized calcium level. So it doesn't take a whole lot to reach an ion to activate the muscle or the nerve, and that's the mechanism of tetany. So you're lowering the threshold, the nerve threshold. In hypercalcemia, the exact opposite. You're raising the threshold, so it takes more ionized calcium in order to activate the nerve. Okay? That's the mechanism. I can't tell you how this is to drive me crazy because of the squares and all that crap, and this is how I'm going to explain parathormone and calcium disorders for you. Okay, so if I were you, I'd just look at this, because you do have this there. I'm going to do all the calcium abnormalities just with this. because this is the way they asked them. They put it in a graph form. That's clever. So they have serum parathormone on the y-axis. They have total calcium on the x-axis. You don't know how long it took me to remember that it's the y-axis. I have to do something. Y, I make believe I'm a letter Y, is the one that's up. Okay, that means the other one's the other one. So this one's the X. Sometimes they actually forget that, and I have to go, okay, Y is this, X is that. Then they put this stinking square there, and they say, the square represents the normal values in a normal patient. I say, I don't get it. How does this represent the normal values in a normal patient? I just didn't get it. I just didn't say, wow, what does it mean? Finally it dawned, and I'm not kidding on this. This is not a joke. This is sad, actually. Finally it dawned on me that the height of this square represented the serum parathormone level, and the width of that square represented the serum calcium level. I can't tell you how long it took me to figure that out. Never got it, but one day it dawned on me. Now I know what it means. Now maybe some of you do too. So let's start with it, okay? We're not going to do all of these things like A, B, and B, and A, C. We're going to deal with A, C, D, and E, because those are the main ones that we need to know for board purposes. So let's interpret A. What's the serum calcium in this patient here? Okay, it's low because it's over here. Okay, the normal calcium level would be over here, and this is to the left of it. But and what's also the parathormone level? Well, it's low because this is the parathormone. So we have a low parathormone level and a low calcium. So what is that? Primary hypoparathyroidism. So that's easy. Now we got that. Just have to discuss, and we're done with it. Most common cause: previous thyroid surgery. So let's say they went in and removed the thyroid gland for cancer. A very strong chance that all the glands that they left behind because of reaction to injury, infarcted, gone. So that's now why they nowadays auto transplant. If they're going to take the whole thyroid out or most of the thyroid out, and they know that they're going to screw up the other ones even though they're there, they'll take them out and put them in the forearm. And, of course, because it's your gland, you're not going to reject it unless, of course, you're one of those people that think everything's going to go wrong with you. You have this kind of a negative attitude, then you will actually reject your own gland. Because you reject yourself anyway. Trying to make a little point out of this thing. Now, me, if I had to have auto transplant, where do you think I'd stick it? My butt. I'd stick it in my butt so that every time I sat down, I get a little charge, parathormone, and increased calcium. Okay, and that would, of course, be good for me because that would decrease excitability, right? That would raise it and so kind of settle me down. So that would be a very good thing for me. So you can decide where you want your parathyroid glands to be transplanted. Most of the time, they put them in the forearm, and they grow just fine. Okay. You know, they even did that with a piece of ovums. I heard that on the TV, or not the TV. They were able to take an ovum from a woman and put them in her forearm, and they actually ovulated. The eggs popped during the time that they normally did. You didn't hear about this? This is truth. I know you're thinking that. You know. No, this is actually true. It was on the radio. I was hearing this thing. That's unbelievable. I think they were going to like radiate the woman's something like that. She had cancer, and so she's still in the reproductive. She still wanted to have her own baby. So they harvested some of her eggs from her ovary, and implanted them in her forearm, and they remained alive. And she noticed that the time that she normally would have ovulation. It would hurt a little bit in there, and it turned out that when they biopsied one, and they actually showed that it had actually popped off that little piece of ovary that the egg was in. It was amazing. Whatever. So that might be a good way of allowing women to still have eggs even when their ovaries are radiated. Okay, so most commonly it's due to previous thyroid surgery, so they would tell you that. You know, they had a thyroidectomy, and then here's a person with tetany and all that stuff, and you know, hey, I suspect hypoparathyroidism here probably has something to do with that, and of course that would fit A. Okay, now that's easy. How about a little kid, newborn, that has a cyanosis, and is irritable, and when you do an x-ray of the chest, there's no anterior mediastinal shadow. That's DeGeorge syndrome. So remember that. They have hypoparathyroidism along with an absent thymus, or they have pure cellular immune, and they ask that one, of course, that would hit A2. Okay? Now let's deal with C. How do we interpret C in terms of calcium? Low. And how do we interpret in terms of parathormone? high. So what would that have to be? Low calcium, high parathyroid. Shouldn't that be? So that can't be primary hyperparathyroidism. That is secondary. Okay, so whatever is causing hypocalcemia is causing a compensatory increase in parathyroid. That's called secondary hyperparathyroidism. Well, the most common cause of that is renal failure. And why would that be? Because you'll have hypovitaminosis D, which decreases calcium and increases parathyroid. Okay? So any cause of hypocalcemia, okay, assuming that the parathyroid glands are normal, will cause a compensatory increase in parathyroid. Very simple case. So that's that one. Let's do D. Okay? How do you interpret D? Hypercalcemia and hyperparathyroid. I want you to think about that. Hypercalcemia, increased parathyroid? That shouldn't be. So if it's increased in the presence of hypercalcemia, it obviously means, to me at least, that the gland is not obeying negative feedback. So it must be primary hyperparathyroidism. And that's correct. And that would be your most common cause of hypercalcemia in a community. It'd be that right now. So if someone here had hypercalcemia, okay, you would most likely have primary hyperparathyroidism. If you were in a hospital, then that would more likely be malignancy induced. Okay, the most primary hyperparathyroid patients are asymptomatic. If they are symptomatic, they usually have stones, calcium stones. That's the most common symptomatic presentation for primary hyperparathyroidism. So let's think about the laboratory changes. The parathyroid level would be high, right? Calcium level would be high. Now think, what would the phosphate level be? Low, that's right. Because remember, parathyroid normally increases calcium reabsorption and decreases phosphorus reabsorption. So high parathyroid, high calcium, low phosphate. Very good. Okay, that's primary hyperparathyroidism. A little more common in women than men, almost always greater than 50 years of age. Let's deal with E. How would you interpret E? High calcium, but what's the parathyroid? Low. Should that be that way? Yes. If you have a high calcium, you should suppress your parathyroid. So what would that be? All other causes of hypercalcemia except primary hyperparathyroidism. But most commonly, that's going to be due to malignancy. Would it be true also for parathyroid-like peptide causes of hypercalcemia? Mm-hmm. Because it said it's parathyroid like peptide, it's not parathyroid. In other words, it is increasing calcium reabsorption and phosphorus, but when you measure parathyroid, it's not the same molecule. And so whether it's a parathyroid like peptide, tumor producing it, like a squamous of the lung, renal adenocarcinoma, or metastasis to bone, breaking the bone down, or sarcoidosis producing hypercalcemia, multiple myeloma producing hypercalcemia, what's the parathyroid level? Low. So what's the absolute simplest and easiest way to determine the cause of hypercalcemia in a patient? Parathyroid level. What if it's high? Diagnosis. Primary hyperparathyroidism. What if it's low? All the other causes. Pleiades, malignancy. Okay? This is the easiest way of teaching calcium parathyroid disorders. Okay, we basically went through the common ones over here, and these are the ones they would ask on exams, and we gave you the key facts necessary for it. There's a lot more material in there for you, but actually when I do write my notes, I write them for part one, and I also write them for part two to help you along with that too. This picture was on the first computer-based examination of the USMLE. Diagnosis. Cushing's. How do you know? Stria doesn't mean a hill of beans to me. Every obese person has stria. Purple stria. All right. What else do you see? You see thin extremities and central obesity. Don't you? Okay. So let's discuss Cushing's. What's the most common cause of Cushing's? Think common. Someone on long-term steroid therapy. Who would that be? Patient that's, let's say, renal transplants and using it as an immunosuppressant, lupus, something like that. Agree? That's the most common. Now, if that's excluded, then you have to think of three sources. Pituitary Cushing's, which accounts for 2/3 of cases, adrenal Cushing's, ectopic Cushing's. Okay? Those three types of Cushing's. Now, that's just for fun. Which of those three would have the highest ACTH levels? Pituitary, adrenal, or ectopic Cushing's, which is small cell carcinoma? Ectopic, okay. Which one had the lowest ACTH levels? Adrenal. Why? What's it making? It's not making ACTH, guys. What is it making? Cortisol. So what would that do to ACTH? Suppress it. So in other words, ectopic has the highest. Adrenal Cushing's has the lowest. And right in the middle is pituitary Cushing's. Most cases are due to pituitary Cushing's, a benign tumor making ACTH. With me so far? Okay, here we go. Now, there's two great screening tests for Cushing's. When you've excluded the fact that they're not on steroids, then the screening tests are a 24-hour urine for free cortisol. Now, free cortisol doesn't mean that when you order it that you don't have to pay anything for it. Basically, what it means is that it's cortisol that's in your urine, not attached to any protein. So it's free. It must mean that you had a lot of excess of it for there to be that much of it in your urine. That is the single best test, screening test, for Cushing's. According to New England Journal of Medicine article, Medical Progress on Cushing's Syndrome. So that's the absolute single best test for distinguishing Cushing's syndrome from Cushingoid obesity. Because the majority of people that you think have Cushing's, you could swear when you see an obese person that looks like they have a moon face. They all plethoric. And you can convince yourself that they're purple stria, okay? And they have just classic, you know, they look like they're Cushing's, okay? And you get a 24-hour urine for free cortisol, normal. That's what you're going to see most of the time. Okay, but if it's increased, they truly have Cushing's. In other words, it has about like 99-something% sensitivity and specificity. It's excellent, excellent test. But that's not the one they'll ask you. They're going to ask you about suppression tests because they know that'll screw you up. Okay? And so the suppression test is a dexamethasone suppression test. Low dose, high dose? Okay, no, both. Okay, they do both. Okay. I was just saying, Lodo is not, no, like, a question. That's very good. You're with it. You're right here. You're responding. This is good. Okay, the lack of response means you know where they are right now. Thinking about food. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Now, what is dexamethasone? It's a cortisol analog. Now, I had problems with what the heck that always meant. What's an analog mean? It acts like cortisol, but isn't cortisol. So what does cortisol do? Let's say I don't have Cushing's. Let's say you give me dexamethasone, and it's acting like cortisol. What should that do to me? Well, that should suppress my ACTH. And if you're suppressing that, then what should my cortisol level be? Low. Which would mean that I was suppressible. But what do you think you're going to get if you use a low dose of dexamethasone and a patient with Cushing's? Are you going to be able to suppress their cortisol? No. And so you see a lack of suppression. So that's a positive screening test. But it doesn't tell you which of the types it is. It just says, yep, you got Cushing's. Of course, the 24-hour urine for free cortisol would be increased. So now, remember I gave you two exceptions to the rule for a overproductive type of endocrine disease that you can suppress. And which one did I say you could? Pituitary. And so if you give a high dose of dexamethasone, how much does it matter? This high dose, you are able to suppress the ACTH released by a pituitary tumor, and cortisol goes down. Not so for adrenal Cushing's, not so for ectopic Cushing's due to small cell, forget it. It's actually quite easy on the exam. It's going to be one of these things that is this long, and they give you all its data, and you're knowing and reading the stem of the question that it's Cushing's, okay? Okay? I suggest to you, by the way, when you get long ones, read the last sentence first, in my opinion, because it tells you what it is they want. They don't want a diagnosis, they don't want a mechanism, and that way when you're reading it, you have some idea what it is they're going to ask. A lot of times you go reading it, says, I know what this is, and then it goes to, the patient has diabetes mellitus, And, you know, they give you the stupid answer, and you go, absolutely ape nerd, okay? And you write it down, just in case you can't, because you can't touch the computer screen. And you just go crazy and have to read the whole stupid thing over again because you weren't thinking about that. You were thinking they just wanted a diagnosis. You understand? Look at the last sentence on the big ones. Find out what it is they want. And that way you can read it with more focus, okay, and do much better. So you know it's Cushing's and you're reading the thing, okay? And then you look at the thing and they want to know which type. So you say, this is the first thing I do, look at the high-dose dexamethasone suppression test. And if you see that, it suppresses pituitary Cushing's. I might add, everyone to date has been pituitary Cushing's on the boards. Okay, every single one of them has been that way. Okay, so it's not a hard question to get right. Okay, I just very quickly am going to explain for you, almost with trepidation, because you haven't had Hansen yet, why they look like this. Okay. Now, you have hypercortisolism, agreed? Cortisol is gluconeogenic, agreed? So you need substrates for gluconeogenesis. What's your main substrate from your gluconeogenesis? Amino acids. From where? Muscle. Where your muscle's located? Arms, legs. So you're going to get a breakdown of muscle in the extremities. That's why they have thin arms, thin legs. And then you're going to get the alanine. You transaminate it, and you get your pyruvate. So you're always going to have thin arms and extremities if you have hypercortisolism, okay? And since it is gluconeogenic, what's your glucose going to be? Okay. What does that do to insulin release? Increases it. Okay? What does insulin do to fat? Increases fat storage. What parts of your body have most of the adipose? Your face and your trunk. And so you're just basically getting, from an insulin effect, an increase in deposition of triglyceride in your face, your back for your buffalo hump and trunk. So the thin extremities is due to breaking down muscle to get amino acids for gluconeogenesis. The moon faces, buffalo hump, and truncal obesity is due to the increase in insulin with increasing fat deposition. The stretch marks are due to normal obesity, and the reason why they're purple is that cortisol decreases collagen synthesis. You get structurally weaker collagen. In a sense, you know what, remember senile purpura? Remember that? It's basically purpura within the stretch mark. You break down the vessels in there because of the increase in cortisol, and that's why they're purple, and that's why that is such a very, very good marker, because it clearly means there is vessel instability there, and that goes along with hypercortisolism. There you go. That's how you get like this. Okay, what sign does this patient have with the thumb going in there? Trousseau sign. What does it mean? Tetany. Okay. What if I told you this patient has hypertension, hypernatremia, hypokalemia, metabolic alkalosis? What's your diagnosis? Primary aldosteronism. Why do they have tetany? Because I just went through it with you before. And when you have alkalosis, what happens to the number of negative charges on albumin? Increases. What happens to your ionized calcium level? Decreases tetany. That combination, guys, hypertension, hypernatremia, hypokalemia, metabolic alkalosis, tetany, is primary aldosteronism, otherwise known as Kahn's syndrome. That's it in that one. This has your adrenal medulla tumors. This is most common in adults. Who am I? Both of these patients have hypertension. Adult hypertension, adrenal medulla tumor. Who am I? Pheochromocytoma, benign or malignant? Benign. And in kid, hypertension, neuroblastoma, benign or malignant? Malignant. Okay? So both of these tumors, one's benign, one's malignant, both are in the adrenal medulla, both are of neural crest origin, okay? Both produce hypertension, okay? Except pheochromocytoma more common in adults and neuroblastoma more common in kids, okay? In terms of what would make you think that you had a patient with pheochromocytoma if they had hypertension? The answer is this. They would be a person that had very, very, very unstable hypertension. Listen, anxiety. They're very anxious. Three, they sweat a lot. I kind of call it the Danny DeVito syndrome. Anytime I see Danny DeVito, okay, he's always sweating. He's always anxious and frenetic. If he had hypertension, I would clearly get a 24-hour urine for metanephrine and Daniel Mandelicus. There is no doubt in my mind. That kind of person, anxious, sweating all the time, hypertension, that's when you get your 24-hour urine for metanephrine, which is actually the best test, and your 24-hour urine for Daniel Mandelic acid. Those are metabolic end products of epinephrine and norepinephrine. Okay, that's when you do it. Are there associations with pheochromocytoma with other things? We already mentioned some. We had MEN2A. We had MEN2B. Okay. We have neurofibromatosis with a high association. Matter of fact, they gave a question of a patient with neurofibromatosis who had hypertension. Okay, and they said, what test are you going to get? The answer was 24-hour urine for metanephrine or VMA because of that high association of pheochromocytomas with neurofibromatosis. So, yes, there are associations. Okay, this is going to be asked because this is hot right now. That's a gram-negative diplococcus. This is a child, let's say 12, who had high fever, nuchal rigidity. You did a tap. And you found neutrophils in there, a spinal tap, and gram negatives. All of a sudden, the kid crashed. Kids start getting petechial lesions all over the body. And then when hypovolemic on you, went into shock and died. You did an autopsy, and you found out that both adrenal glands were hemorrhaged. Diagnosis, Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Organism, Neisseria meningitis. Listen very carefully on Neisseria meningitis. Most common cause of meningitis from 1 month to 18 years of age. Listen carefully. It's the only meningitis with petechial lesions. And they always mention that. So they give you a classic meningitis. You know, look what you know it is. And they say petechial lesions, you can stop thinking. It's Neisseria meningitis. And then they start talking about hypotensive shock, and you know that they hemorrhaged their adrenals and they went into a they have no cortisol, and they have no mineralocorticoids. Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome. Okay? They love that particular question. Very, very common. Very, very common thing. Now, we know that a cause of hypocortisolism that's chronic is Addison's disease. And by far and away, the most common cause of Addison's disease is autoimmune. Autoimmune destruction of the gland. In the old days, it used to be tuberculosis. You know, as miliary spread was a big, big cause of it. Not so much now. Now it's most commonly autoimmune. So let's brainstorm Addison's just quickly. You're destroying the entire adrenal cortex. So that means the mineralocorticoid and the glucocorticoid aspects. So you have low cortisol, and what's your ACTH? High. What's that doing to your melanocytes in your skin? Increasing them, and where are you going to see hyperpigmentation? In the mouth. And elsewhere. Okay. Two, let's talk about the mineralocorticoid act. No aldosterone. Two pumps. Sodium potassium pump, proton potassium pump. No aldosterone. Are you going to lose salt? Big time. So you're going to have hyponatremia. Are you going to retain potassium? Hyperkalemia. Peak T waves. Are you going to be able to get rid of protons into the urine? Metabolic acidosis. So hyponatremia, hyperkalemia, metabolic acidosis. Hyperpigmentation, got your diagnosis of Addison's. Relatively straightforward, simple diagnosis, not hard at all. Is that a normal genitalia in this newborn? You don't know, do you? So it's ambiguous, agreed? What's your first step in the management of this newborn, since it's ambiguous genitalia? Come on, that's your board question, guys. That's what they asked. Chromosome analysis. You have to find out what the genetic sex is. It's XX. So, ambiguous genitalia, female. Phenotypically, you can't tell. So it's a female pseudohermaphrodite. Play odds. Adrenogenital syndrome and agreed. 21-hydroxylase deficiency. That's correct. Okay? Now, Porter taught you this. Right? Don't say no. You did, right? Lie. You lie, little man from Costa Rica. Porter did a good job on that. But when you take a look at that graph that I have of look at the diagram of steroids. So it better be in there. Keep on going. There you go. What page are you on? It's the one after page 99. Take a look at that diagram on page 99. That's going to be in the new book that I'm writing with another guy in biochemistry. That diagram there is one of the best diagrams you will ever see on this syndrome. It has everything in one place. Okay. Now, I'm going to do it for you too, just in case you don't get it, because you're guaranteed. Everyone in this room is going to get an adrenal genital syndrome question, no doubt about it. Okay, so you got to know the main actors before you be able to answer these questions. So you got to know what 17 ketos are. You got to need to know what 17 hydroxys are. You have to know what 21 and 11 and 17 hydroxylase are. Otherwise, you are screwed. In other words, if you can't duplicate this chart, then you're not going to get the questions right. It will take you 10 minutes to do it. All right. Notice that the 17 hydroxylases are responsible for 17 ketosteroids. That's why 17 hydroxylases. And they include DHEA, which you already knew about, and androstenedione. They are weak androgens. Androstenedione can be converted into testosterone, okay, and then testosterone to the dihydrate. So the 17 ketosteroids are DHEA and androstenedione. Testosterone is not a 17 keto. What are 17 hydroxycorticoids? Those are these dudes. Okay, that's 11-deoxycortisol and cortisol. Those are 17 hydroxycorticoids. And you notice why they're 17 is because you have a 17 hydroxylase here to form 17 hydroxyprogesterone, and that's where they develop from. So if you have an increase in 17 hydroxycorticoids, that's an increase in 11-deoxycortisol and cortisol. If you have an increase in 17 ketosteroids, it's DHEA and androstenedione. Do you have that understanding? Do you have that understanding? Good. When you have an enzyme deficiency, things proximal to the block what? Decrease. Things distal to the block, increase. Okay? So here's 21 hydroxylase. Do you see it? Wait. Things like, you have this, things of 21 hydroxylase, things distal to the block decrease. Good. Things proximal. It's getting close. My mind just goes out. I have neuroglycopenia by this time. So distal to the block decrease, proximal increase. Very good. I'm glad you had that little squinched up facial. No. It was cool. You did that. That was good. All right, now I can't see because I have glaucoma. All right. You have 21 hydroxylase deficient. Draw a line across that. So everything distal decreases. Well, these are all your mineralocorticoids. Decreased. And your 17 hydroxycorticoids. Decreased. 17 ketos. Proximal. Increased. You're a baby. You're a female. You got all this excess androgens. What's going to happen to your genitalia? Ambiguous. 17 hydroxys. Decreased. How about the mineralocorticoid part? Missing. So you're going to retain salt or lose it? Lose it. Salt loser. So you're basically like an Addison's. You're basically like an Addison's. What's your ACTH level of cortisol's decreased? High. That's why all the children are hyperpigmented. Done. Right, 11 hydroxylase deficiency, a little bit below there. Okay? Okay, what's decreased? Cortisol. Okay, corticosterone, aldosterone. What's increased? Look, 11-deoxycorticosterone, is that a mineralocorticoid? Uh-huh. Is 11-deoxycortisol increased? Uh-huh. So what's your 17 hydroxycorticoids in this patient? Increased. In 21, it was decreased because it blocks here, and both of these were decreased. 11's here, that's increased, that's decreased. So the 70 hydroxys is increased. Are your 17 ketos increased? Mm-hmm. What's the little girl going to look like? Bigger genitalia. What's the little boy going to look like? Precocious puberty. Because he's going to have an excess in androgens. Is he a salt loser or is he a salt retainer? Retainer. So what is he going to have? Hypertension. That's it. How about 17 hydroxylase deficiency? So you're missing these. So are you going to have any 17 ketoids? Ketosteroids? No. Are you going to have any 17 hydroxycorticoids if you're missing this? No. But are you going to have an increase in mineralocorticoids since it had absolutely nothing to do with the synthesis of mineralocorticoids? Okay. So they're going to be increased. What's the patient going to have? Hypertension. What if it's a little boy with the low 17 ketosteroids? No testosterone. He's going to look like a female. because he would not have in his development, because he's 70-hydroxylase deficiency, he would not be able to form 17 ketones, testosterone, or dihydrotestosterone. So his external genitalia would look female. What about the little girl? Well, she's going to have, you know, underdeveloped. She'd be underdeveloped. So that's that one. Done. I mean, you did that in less than 5 minutes. You did it in 3 minutes? Yeah, because that's it's not all that hard. It's pretty easy. If you know this. Look how beautiful this is. I don't know if you notice this. This is your zona glomerulosa here, guys, because there's your mineralocorticoids. There's your zona fasciculata, guys, because there's your glucocorticoids. There's your zona reticularis, guys, because there's your 17 ketosteroids and androgens. Have you ever seen a schematic like this? No. Did I make this up? No. It was in a postgraduate medicine article 25 years ago, and the guy's dead. And so I have changed it around a little bit. I put arrows in it that weren't there, and I shaded these things over here, and they weren't there, and now it is mine! Am I weird or what? You bet. And I love it. Islet cell tumors. Islet cell tumors. You sound like you're nauseous. You're not going to be able to do this in 3 minutes? Sure I can. Because there's only two that you need to know. Insulinoma and ZE syndrome. You already know what that is. You're making too much gastrin. You have peptic ulcers. End of discussion. Okay? All right? Now you know what the question is going to be on insulinoma. Is the dude injecting insulin into himself, or does he really have an insulinoma? Isn't that what it's going to be? Of course. And you know that's totally simple because you learned that insulin, when you break proinsulin down into insulin, you release C-peptide. So for every insulin molecule you release, you have a C-peptide that corresponds with it. So obviously, if you inject human insulin into yourself and produce a low glucose level, your insulin will be elevated because you injected. But what's your C-peptide going to be? Suppressed. And if you really had an islet cell tumor, okay, you'd have hypoglycemia, a high insulin level, but what would your C-peptide be? Increased. I mean, how hard is that? But you know what? The boards knew that. The question was a pharmacist. You see, people that have access to insulin are the ones that get this. So that's us, nurses, and pharmacists, because we have access to insulin. And they, on the first test that they gave, they truly made it. The guy injecting himself. Okay, in other words, the insulin was high and the C-peptide was low. And then all the news got out, you know, how everyone emails each other and all that. Well, the boards knew that you did that. Okay, because they knew that that information was added. So guess what they did on future exams? They used the same exact stem, except they changed one thing in it. That was the C-peptide level. And he made it increased. They didn't make it decrease, they increased it. And that made it what? An insulinoma. And a whole pile of people got that wrong. A whole pile of people said, oh man, this is the pharmacist question. I already know the answer. Boop. Okay. They didn't even look at the C-peptide. Boop, boop. That's what you really should have done. Okay? You gotta look. You don't think these board guys are stupid, do you? They know that you're going to be telling each other about these things, and so they really got one on a lot of you. Okay, they just did the same question. They just changed the C-peptide level, okay, and they made it high, and that changed it suddenly. A pharmacist with an insulinoma, okay? All right. Okay, when we come back, that's if you come back, we're going to do diabetes and keep on moving.